This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Dr. David Kaufman, MSU neurologist and concussion researcher.
It really is a pleasure to welcome Dr. David Kaufman to the program. David is one of those extraordinary physicians, in my view. We're so proud to have at Michigan State. He is an individual who, neurologist, but who stays very connected to the lives of his patients and our sports teams. And concussions are a major point of discussion in athletics. I think it's often seen as a football issue, but we know very much it occurs in soccer and softball and lots of things that happen in lacrosse with those sticks that people tend to bang people in the head with. And David's just been a leader in not simply treating concussions, but in studying and thinking about concussions in sports. So, David, it's a pleasure to have you here, and I'll let Mark have the first question.
Well, it is. You know, like President Simon says, it's we're blessed to look on our sideline and see you there, but more importantly, see you throughout the community. I think, you know, one of the topics as an AD of my concern is concussions are at the top of mind awareness, I think, of a lot of people in professional college and high school sports. Can you just give us a brief overview of where you believe we are at today as far as the topic of concussion in sport?
It's been a surprise that the interest in concussion has risen so dramatically over the last few years, Mark. This is a well-known disease to neurologists and to primary care physicians, but there's been an avalanche of information and also hearsay that has developed over the last few years. The key, I think, is to inoculate the discussion with rigor and scientific fact. And most regrettably, there is not an enormous amount of science that has been brought into the conversation. And so I think that's the role of major universities such as our own. The research-intense universities are to bring scientific reality into this debate.
You were actively involved with our work in terms of keeping track data longitudinally well before this was a more fashionable topic of discussion. Also, you've been active in the Big Ten Ivy League study on concussions to try to, again, bring some understanding scientifically to the issues. So what are your impressions about where we stand now with this sort of the work, particularly the Big Ten Ivy League? I know that NCAA has now gotten actively involved in this. In this work?
One of the most interesting meetings I've been at during my academic life was the Big Ten Ivy League consortium meeting at the Big Ten offices in Chicago this July. In that room were assembled all of the CIC Big Ten schools. In addition to each of the eight Ivy schools sent three representatives to discuss the current state of research at each of their institutions, what direction people wanted to head, and how to set up a very broad consortium between the two most visible leagues, both athletically and academically, to begin to answer this question that's taken on such a public health focus. What I noticed at that meeting was a collegial interaction between not only the Ivies and the Big Tens, but even schools like the Wolverines and the Spartans. It was very interesting to see that, and how people want to work together to bring scientific rigor into this question.
The issue that I know was discussed at the meeting is whether we should be doing some baseline imaging for student athletes, because this is I wanted you to talk a bit about this. There's a neurobiology of this that would suggest that there are individual differences in how people react to a strike in the head, let me use that, or a bump of the head, where some people react very seriously to something that would be viewed as minor for another person. And so how are we thinking about, you know, but this is a long-term issue as well as a treatment issue?
That's incredibly insightful of you, President Simon. I think that understanding objective radiographic biomarkers is one of the most important things we can bring into this debate. Right now, it is subjective. We do have neurologic evaluations done by folks such as myself or team physician Randy Pearson. We look at people with computer-assisted neuropsych evaluations, but there is no objective biomarker. Placing objective biomarkers into this question, I think, would be a very important thing in terms of understanding the disease process and properly approaching this topic.
And how hard is that to do? Tell people what that means for our listeners and what we're, you know, what you're thinking about in terms of doing that for our student athletes.
The end result of the work is quite simple. It uses very advanced MRI techniques that are available literally nationwide. Here at Michigan State, I believe we're particularly blessed by an outstanding radiology group. The advanced MRI techniques look at the neurochemistry and physical chemistry of the brain and can give us an understanding of brain connectivity, different than looking at anatomy. In other words, a normal MRI would look at anatomy, whereas these advanced functional MRI studies look at the biology of the brain in a more meaningful way. In concussion, it's exceptional that there's any anatomic problem. The issue is the neurochemistry, the actual way nerves talk with one another is disrupted. That is what a concussion is. These advanced MRI techniques can allow us to understand baseline how these athletes do, whether or not they're susceptible, and whether or not they are shielded appropriately after a concussion for a more accurate return to play decision. These functional MRI studies are underway at a number of different institutions. I'm delighted to tell you that Michigan State has been involved with these studies now for the last 19 months in terms of looking at folks with concussion and then following them through a 30-day cycle to see how the physical chemistry of the brain changes.
As a student athlete is injured, we'll say a soccer player, the president, AD, head coach, doctor, trainer, are all concerned about the individual. What are the variables that a person like myself or a coach needs to be aware of that goes into the conversation, the side of the head versus the front of the head, the person themselves? What are the factors that should be really thought through by the coach and the AD relative to recovery and when to put them back out on the field?
The important thing to highlight is these advanced MRI techniques need to be validated prior to coming into general use. I do not advocate the use of MRI or advanced MRI techniques yet, but MSU and a number of other Big Ten and Ivy League institutions are looking at this for validation of these advanced biomarker techniques. Stepping back and thinking through routine concussion, let us say, we have a daughter that is involved in a soccer match where she heads the ball for a goal, but afterwards feels headache and a bit woozy. The key, number one thing, is to diagnose whether or not she's winded from running or whether or not she suffered a concussion. So the number one item is the diagnosis. And what I've learned from folks like Jeff Covan and Sally Nogol is sports medicine is a different discipline than neurology. It just is. You have to be able to look at an athlete and decide if they have changed in terms of their thinking process or if there's something else going on that implies that a concussion has occurred. So in shorter response, diagnosis. Once the diagnosis has been made, it is important to recognize that the athlete has to be put at rest until the symptoms dissipate and that they can exercise without danger. And these are protocols that have been brought into the mix recently. I would say over the last 2 years, people have made sideline diagnoses far better than they have in the past.
Before we return back to maybe some of the big picture and research, If you're involved in youth sports, whether it be the high school or mid-school level, what advice do you have to that adult that's out there on the field and sees a person? And can a concussion even really be diagnosed on the sideline of a sporting event? And I always go to the side of precaution, but what advice do you give to that adult that's out there that's in charge of a team when a head injury occurs?
First, they have to be trained to recognize a concussion. Virtually all coaches are aware of the situation. Many of them have training to evaluate. And being careful is always prudent, Mark. There's no question about it. In the heat of competition, you must always place the student athlete first. You just must. Mm-hmm. But you also have to be rational. People that walk off a football field and are winded or just take time to settle themselves are different than those that have suffered a concussion. So the ability to tell the difference between the two many times comes down to experience.
And Big Ten athletic directors and we're working collaboratively with USA Football on teaching what to look for with those young coaches.
There's a lot of people getting a lot of attention about putting sensors in helmets and all of these kinds of things. Good technology doesn't replace the judgment of people on the field. Could that give you a false sense of security?
I believe that all technology has to be an extension of the clinical exam. It is up to the clinician or the coach to look at an individual and then decide if technology can assist with the clinical impression. If you're led around by technology, that's when physicians and athletic trainers, I think, get into trouble. So number one is the common sense and judgment of a well-meaning individual at the moment of truth when someone comes off the sideline. There has been considerable interest in putting in force detectors, the ability to measure force. Virginia Tech has done some excellent work in putting monitors to measure force inside the helmets of their student athletes. And this has been quite interesting in terms of helping raise the suspicion of who may have had a concussion and who may not have by detecting the force of a blow. It is interesting, deserves careful scientific evaluation. I do not believe it will ever replace common sense judgment.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a conversation between MSU neurologist Dr. David Kaufman, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon.
What about the difference between men and women? Is there a gender difference in concussions as there is with sort of knee injuries?
Well, that's probing some very valuable research done by Tracy Kovacin, who is a tenured faculty member at our university. One of the major things I saw at the Big Ten meetings was they asked six individuals to get up and review the work at their universities because they were considered leaders. One of the people invited to talk was Tracy Kovacin, who's in our athletic training program, received tenure a few years ago. Her landmark work is looking at gender differences in concussion. And she has shown in a definitive way that at the high school level, women are more susceptible than men to concussion. Same force, same types of sports, same sorts of collisions, women are more vulnerable.
And the reason for that is?
I think that it probably is a complex thing dealing with a variety of different factors. It could be as simple as skull thickness, the amount of cerebrospinal fluid. It could be as radical as the musculature of the neck. Her work is quite definitive in terms of the vulnerability of women.
You and I have talked about these issues for a very long time, and we're really pleased that we have you on the sidelines as well to add professional expertise to the judgments. If you and I were having this conversation 3 to 5 years from now, what advances would you want to have happened based on the research and the work that we're doing?
My number one hope would be that common sense still rules the day and that there would be no change in terms of what I've observed. as an academic being invited into an athletic situation, I have to tell you I'm quite pleased in terms of what I've seen from our sports medicine physicians, President Simon. I believe the common sense and safety rule of the day, and my hope is that that does not change over the next 5 years. On a go-forward basis, I do not think there will be radical changes in helmets. There may be some advances in helmets, but I don't think there'll be radical changes in helmets. I do believe the game will continue to be made safer based on athletic directors' insistence about rules and careful observation of the number of exposures to head collisions, changes in the frequency of full practice, making sure each of our student athletes understands how to tackle correctly, putting in penalty situations to reduce the number of dangerous hits, I think will be all things that we'll see to reduce the number of exposures. And I think one of the major things is we have to see a reduction in the exposures that our student athletes come in contact with.
So what do we do about sports like hockey? I'll pick my old sport of softball when people are running into one another instead of sliding and trying to jar the ball out, or soccer, lacrosse, with sticks that to the helmet, and field hockey.
Wild pitch in baseball.
So those kinds, what do we think about other sports? Because football is getting a lot of attention, and as it should, given the collisions and given what we believe to be the long-term effect of repetitive injury.
Mm-hmm.
But also sort of these other sports of soccer, we're starting kids out so young. And the collegiate game is becoming much more sophisticated.
With not much downtime, I might add. You've got kids that are competing at young ages, but for a long period of time.
These are very interesting questions that have to be studied in a scientific way. What we have right now are conjecture. I think one of the most important studies was the Mayo Clinic study that came out regarding football, where in Olmsted County, where the Mayo Clinic is located, they looked at all football players from the 1950s and 60s and compared them long-term from high school football up to elder ages, and then compared them to non-football players to determine if there was an increased risk of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or other neurodegenerative diseases. Quite interestingly, there is no difference. There was no difference between the high school football players and the general population in terms of the development of these neurodegenerative diseases that afflict the elderly. So I thought that was an important statement regarding longitudinal exposure. In terms of other sports, women, men, and other sports are not immune to concussion. They just aren't. Anybody that has watched a hockey game in one arena understands that there are collisions that occur. But I want to reiterate to both of you and to folks listening that this is a problem that almost always goes away after 2 to 7 days. Almost always, 90% of people do very, very well. The remaining 10%, most people may have some residual that may last more than a week. It's an exceptional person that has a long-standing issue with post-concussion syndrome. We're dealing with a very frequent event. Most of these cases do very, very well. It is the extraordinary ones that we've all focused on, but it's important to understand statistically, most athletes do great.
Does nutrition make a difference in things like nutrition? Are there things that are ancillary to hitting your head and sort of making sure that people are recovered correctly that help with recovery? So let me do that piece. There's rest, obviously. Are there other things that as you try to deal with someone who's been diagnosed with a concussion that helps them move through this process that increases the odds of recovery or other things?
Of course. So there are visceral issues associated with concussion. Right now, we do not have a therapeutic strategy to hasten the recovery of neuronal cells that have absorbed an impact. But the thing about concussion is a variety of visceral things, such as sleep disturbance, cognitive disturbance, your ability to think and reason, visceral disturbances such as nausea and vomiting, balance issues, and emotion. These five ancillary aspects are the things that need to be treated to assist people with recovery. Individuals that have concussion will complain of headache. That needs to be treated. If they have sleep disturbances, those need to be evaluated and helped. Problems with cognition usually require rest. Those with nausea need to be appropriately handled in that way. Those with balance issues as a residual need to go through the therapeutic strategy of rehabilitation. So it's the ancillary things that need to be treated.
So if you were a parent and your kid had a bump in the head and you thought things were okay, and they began to have any one of these five things maybe a couple days afterwards that they didn't clear up, those would be things to worry about after a bump on the head.
I think if somebody had a bump on the head, a well-meaning parent has to decide if their kid's trying to get out of homework or...
Spoken like a true parent.
thank you, Luann. I appreciate that. So, again, common sense has to rule the day. If someone has been involved with a soccer match and she has taken an elbow to the head, afterwards feels a little dizzy, has headache, is not capable of sleeping that night or sleeps over an extended period of time, wakes up with nausea, and also has dizziness, the parent has to think about the possibility of an undiagnosed concussion that has revealed itself later. I believe that's a very important thing to get out to our listeners.
Because not every concussion reveals itself initially as strongly as we imagine. It's not the sort of, I've been knocked out on the field, or I might sort of believe that I can get back in the game because my adrenaline is all up and I'm a tough kid. But some of these things do present themselves a bit later. And it is important to have things checked if that happens.
Absolutely correct. And I think that's a very important thing to highlight is that during competition, athletes may not realize that they have the visceral related associated features of a concussion. That is why at Michigan State University, after every game the following day in football, players are asked to come into the training room if they have any signs or symptoms that could be related to any physical injury, whether or not it be orthopedic or neurologic. We always have a training room the following day just for that safety issue.
I would like to go back to the president's question on nutrition. You know, the better you eat, the stronger your body is from the standpoint of competition and being physical. Has there been research done on not the recovery but the prevention and the way people eat? If you eat a cheeseburger and a milkshake every day, are you more susceptible to concussions than if you eat a healthy, balanced meal? Has there been any research done in that area? Your muscles are stronger if you eat better, therefore you would theorize – potentially your brain would be stronger. Is that a fair question?
Mark, of course, it's a fair question. If I were to eat a hamburger and a milkshake every day, my wife would give me a concussion.
So it prevents concussions.
There you go.
There
is emerging research in looking at a variety of different foods to shield student athletes against concussion. That is being looked at in a very aggressive way by a number of different individuals. To look at that in a scientifically meaningful way would require a properly performed prospective study, placebo-controlled. In short, the proper science has not yet emerged to let us know specifically whether or not any food will shield against concussion. But that is an incredibly interesting question. And it is the sort of question that the Big Ten and the Ivy League, if they bind together and do a properly controlled randomized trial, may help us get to that answer.
I think one of the great things about, we hear, people hear President Obama announcing a brain initiative, and they'll think, another bunch of scientists sort of worrying about things. We really don't know much about the neurobiology of the brain. It's an area. It really is a frontier of science. Mm-hmm. For all the things we do about the technology of imaging, that helps us to sort of see if there's a tumor or there's something that's a blood clot or sort of what I would call these the more visible, I'm not sure they're mechanical, but the things that you can see, the neurobiology of the brain is something that is extraordinarily unknown. And so this really, and then if you think about neurobiology, then genetic structures, genetic dispositions, the kinds of toxins in your body that come from food, the way you process certain minerals. I mean, all those questions are open to exploration and discovery, both in a sense of predisposition, but also in a sense of treatment paradigms. And or could you, by changing, let's say you're a pro football player, pick that as an example, and you know that over the course of a period of time, you're going to be more susceptible to repeated bumping of your head, because we don't know for sure whether it's really huge strikes that the kind people talk about, or whether over time there's just a repetitive component that none of them are really that severe in the sense of, you know, the symptoms we're talking about, but repetitively over time, right? Over time, all those big hits accumulate. We don't know those things. But if we did, then could we essentially develop other approaches that could insulate some of the negative effects? You can never take them away, but what are those big questions? And I'm just really proud that the Big Ten, the Ivy League, have been out in front of these issues well before it was fashionable or well before lawsuits were filed. I'm also really pleased that, you know, over the years with the work that we've done in biomechanics, that we worried about helmets and neck restraints and some other things that were part of the research here. There's just a lot to be done.
To share in that no matter where we travel, no matter where we go, to hear Dr. Kaufman's name, not only he but the team here at Michigan State, brings a lot of pride to Michigan State. And it's you look on the sideline, and you know, I don't always approach him, but I always smile every time I see him because of the value he delivers to Michigan State every day.
It's true, and so we're really proud of that. And we also know that the frontiers of understanding are still both exciting and a bit far away from us as we try to work on these issues. So, David, it really is a great honor to have you as part of MSU's team, but also as a national, international leader in looking at these issues.
What a privilege to work at this university. My thanks.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was Dr. David Kaufman, MSU neurologist and concussion researcher, talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Up next, Dr. Kirk Heinze in our sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment talks with MSU turf grass guru Kevin Frank about what you should be doing now to ensure you have as lush a lawn as possible next spring.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Making a Michigan State University education accessible to all is a key pillar of President Simon's Boulder by Design initiative. And that's why MSU Alumni Association chapters around the world raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarship money each year. Our members share our belief that the same educational experiences we enjoyed should be available to future generations of Spartans. That's why we support MSU's innovative Grandparents University, where you and your grandchild can learn from some of Michigan State's most gifted professors. It's why we touch thousands of lives each year with our career enrichment seminars. And it's why MSU Alumni Association chapters are among the first to welcome new students at dozens of annual freshman family picnics in every city from Detroit to D.C. The MSU Alumni Association was founded to add Spartan value throughout your Spartan life. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Watch him as the world goes.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, we're at the beginning stages of the fall season, which means it's time for another lawn care chat with MSU turf grass expert, Kevin Frank. Kevin is at Michigan State University. His work is also funded in part by MSU Ag Bio Research. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
What a difference a year makes. Last fall, we were wondering about the impacts of a lot of dry weather, and this summer, it's been pretty green.
Yeah, most of the state has had a good year for growing grass. And when you look at home lawns especially, most folks, they got through pretty good. There were some couple little dry stretches, couple heat stretches, but you know, overall, it's been a great year for growing turf on your lawns.
Yeah, has the moisture level been higher than normal or about normal? Or, I mean, why everything stayed green throughout the summer?
You know, I think there were two keys to that. One was that early on we had, of course, abundant moisture. But primarily, you looked at a lot of it, and, you know, we grow cool season turf in this state primarily. That's what everybody focuses on. And when you had, there were some periods in August there where you had nighttime temperatures that were in the 60s every night, and then, you know, maybe low 80s for the highs. It's just ideal weather. Mm-hmm. Ideal weather for growing that grass. And then you threw in relatively frequent precipitation, and it just kept going. For a lot of people were a little dismayed. They like to maybe not mow a little much in the summer, but it just kept growing all year long.
Well, Kevin, given the different weather conditions, what are some things that folks need to be thinking about as we move into the fall?
You know, right now is really that time where you focus on about three activities. You still can do some seeding work. We're getting a little late now, but if you have, what I'll typically tell people, if you have small patches that, for whatever reason, you know, they might have not come back from maybe the previous summer, or you're just looking to renovate something a little bit. Small patchwork you can still probably do. If you're seeding an entire lawn, you're probably getting to the point where, yeah, you could still do it, but there's no guarantees it's going to get out of the ground and make it through the winter perfectly.
Do our windows get a little longer now? It seems like the fall stay a little warmer, a little bit longer, but are our windows for doing things like reseeding a little bit longer than they were historically, or about the same?
Maybe a little bit. It's hard to, you know, people are always looking for steadfast rules on, hey, what's the absolute latest date? And it's hard to give people an absolute latest date. It might be a little extended from what it previously used to be, but it just depends on the weather. You know, daylight continues to get shorter. We've already had some frost events around. So all those things really slow down that process of getting seed once it's incorporated into the soil to germinate and emerge.
What are some general rules on watering that newly seeded ground this time of the year, particularly if it's getting cool at night?
Yeah, the biggest thing with any new seeding, doesn't matter if it's summer or fall, you got to make sure it stays moist, especially until it gets out of the ground. So the bigger advantage in the fall, of course, is whereas if you were trying to do this in June or July, maybe this year, notwithstanding when we had all the moisture, you might be irrigating 3-4 times a day in the fall. Maybe a tickle at once mid-morning, maybe late afternoon if it's a dryish day, and then you're probably done. So it's definitely a lot easier at this time of year.
And I know you get this question all the time, and our listeners are thinking about this, but we start to get leaf drop on our lawns and things of that nature. What's the right thing to do? Let's assume you've got a pretty hefty amount of foliage that's falling onto your lawn.
Yeah, the challenge with mowing leaves back into turf or mulching them back into turf is essentially, as you indicated, it's a volume issue. I mean, if you've got a relatively, you know, small suburban city lot, you've got some huge maples or oaks out there, it's probably going to be difficult to mow all those leaves back into the turf. So you're probably, in some cases, going to have to pick up some of them then and dispose of them. If you're able to and can keep up on it, mowing the leaves back in is a great addition of organic matter back to the system. There's been some research we've played around in past years with some leaves possibly even having some pre-emergence herbicidal type activities the following spring of decreasing weed germination. So that's something we haven't been able to really put our finger on as far as a particular leaf and or what it might be inhibiting. But I guess the story is with leaves, if you can mow them back in, there's no negatives. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all good stuff as far as, you know, getting organic matter back into the system.
You mentioned in terms of weed growth in the spring and what have you, is there any fertilizing or herbicide pesticide treatments that you recommend in the fall in anticipation of things that may happen in the spring?
Boy, right now you hit it right on the head. Two things, fertilize and especially broadleaf weed control. Many times we burn down our broadleaf weeds such as white clover, ground ivy. Maybe we hit them with something in the summer and we're trying to kill them. And it looks like we got them. Mm-hmm. And then it seems like in about the last 2 weeks, you kind of look around and go, wow, they're all back.
They're all back.
How did that happen?
I know that feeling.
So it's like this latter part of September, first part of October, if you go out there now and spray them with a broadleaf herbicide, our standard joke is you really don't get that revenge factor. You don't get to see the curling, the twisting. But next spring, you'll probably maybe just not notice them. You're kind of like, hey, how come
where did they all
something's
go?
Missing here? And typically it's those weeds because they're doing more storing this time of year, so the herbicides tend to be a little more effective even in the fall.
My guest is Kevin Frank, a frequent guest on this program. He's a turf grass expert at Michigan State University. Kevin, there's always, and we've talked about this before, the concern about how much you put on the lawns or your golf courses or what have you. We're all very conscious now of groundwater, water quality issues, et cetera. What do people need to know about the right amounts of these things to put on their lawns?
I mean, as far as, you know, with of course, any herbicide, you're reading and follow label directions. That's the labels of law as a standard saying. For fertilizers, go off the bag recommendation. As most of your listeners probably know at this point, we've been under a phosphorus restriction in this state for, I think, over a year now. Mm-hmm. So that's going to, as a consumer, you go to the store and you look at your common turf fertilizers. Mm-hmm. Most of them have no phosphorus in them anymore.
Right.
So it's really not anything, from that standpoint, you have to concern yourself with, as long as it's zero on that analysis. Follow the recommended directions on that bag. All those recommended directions are going to deliver right around a pound of nitrogen per 1,000 square foot to your lawn. The biggest things I think to realize as far as a homeowner putting fertilizer on, a couple key things. One, don't leave anything on the pavement. You know, whether it's your sidewalk, you know, curb, whatever it is, try to keep those particles on the turf. If you don't keep them on the turf, sweep them back up, blow them with a leaf blower back into the turf, whatever you do to get them back on site so they're not just running off an impervious surface and ultimately getting in to our waterways. So that's one key thing. Another is, you know, I would encourage people to fertilize this time of year. Traditionally, we've had some recommendations that we've thought, well, maybe if we fertilize even later in the fall, we'll get more benefit out of it. But more recent research has seemed to indicate that if you get it down, even in this, you know, later September, October window, it's probably better because it gives the turf more of a chance to harvest those nutrients. And if you do get a quicker cold turn at the end of fall, you know, the turf will have already had the chance to grab it as opposed to, you know, all of a sudden it's winter and it's not going to use it.
You mentioned the phosphorus-free fertilizers. We recently had a guest on the show from Scotts, actually, who told us about this, and that Michigan was one of the states that has moved aggressively in this area. And that's because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that there are suitable phosphorus levels in the soil. There's the residual phosphorus so that we really don't need to add a whole lot more?
Yeah, essentially with most of our mature home lawns, you know, not anything that we're seeding right now, majority of lawns, especially if you looked at, like, southeast Michigan, adequate in phosphorus levels. We've never been able to document a research benefit from putting additional phosphorus onto a mature lawn that already has adequate phosphorus in the soil. Mm-hmm. So that's a big helping hand to us. We still do have in that restriction the ability, if you take a soil test and your lawn, the soil does show that it's phosphorus deficient, we still have the ability to apply that. So we do have some flexibility within that regulation to still make sound decisions on fertilization if we do need that nutrient.
So it's not a standard that's set in stone for all time.
Exactly. Right? That's why I always try to be careful in saying it's not a phosphorus ban.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, it's more of a restriction that if you need it, you can apply it. But if you don't go to that extra step of taking a soil test showing you need it, then don't apply it. It'd be against our regulations.
But that's sort of a tribute to Michigan and environmental stewardship that we looked at that, where other states are just starting to catch up with us.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, we're a Great Lakes state. You know, that's it's an amazing thing. If you don't live here and you come to the state and you see all the fresh water around, we all want to protect those resources. Mm-hmm. And if you have a healthy, dense lawn, that you do all of the correct management practices, whether it's mowing high, you know, fertilizing at the right time, not over-fertilizing, keeping the particles on site, will have a more sustainable environment and prevent soil erosion. We don't want thin lawns where soil is literally washing off people's lawns into the gutter.
Well, Kevin, as we always mention on the show, but for folks who want to read some of the excellent information that you folks put out, the Turfgrass Group, on lawn care and other things related to the environment, where can they go?
Yeah, the main website is just turf.msu.edu, and we also have a blog page that we update frequently that is msuturf.blogspot.com.
I've been talking with Kevin Frank. He's a turfgrass expert at Michigan State University. His research is funded in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research. Kevin, always great to see you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go Green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai. And even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network, people who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
My name is Michael Shingles, and I'm one of the orthopedic surgeons here at Michigan State University Sports Medicine.
This is MSU Today.
Here at Michigan State University Sports Medicine, we take care of the Michigan State University athletes, but we take care of our community as well. So here at Michigan State University Sports Medicine, we have four primary care or family practice sports medicine docs that work on almost every injury an athlete can have, from head injuries to cardiac injuries to musculoskeletal injuries. And then we have our three orthopedic surgeons here as well who work mostly on musculoskeletal injuries. As an orthopedic surgeon, obviously, I do surgery on different joints in the body, as far as the knee, the ankle, hips, shoulders, my favorite being knee surgery. We also work on fractures, broken bones, muscle injuries, a lot of musculoskeletal trauma. As a sports medicine doc, I work with different athletes of all ages, from peewee to high school to college, professional, and then middle-aged and elderly athletes, because in this society, sports are important and being active is important. So I do see a lot of variety of patients, which is one of the things I love about my practice. And the sports med aspect is trying to keep your patient or athlete healthy and allow them to participate in whatever their sport is for years, and to allow them to do that safely so that they can continue to participate in that sport for years, or in some cases to get them through high school or college sports and still let them have a healthy body when they're finished. So when you combine sports medicine with orthopedics, you have a pretty sometimes challenging but definitely enjoyable profession. One of the great things about working at Michigan State University is we have access to state-of-the-art facilities. We have one of the top radiology programs in the country where we can get almost any image or study that we need regarding the patient's injured extremity. We have top-notch musculoskeletal radiologists who understand how to get the best images and help us read these images to get the most out of them. We have a great training staff who has years of experience regarding treating injuries. And I have great partners who have treated just about every sport, from the Olympic sports all the way through the revenue sports, being hockey, basketball, and football. So a vast amount of experience in which to work with and treat athletes. So that's certainly a great plus here at Michigan State.
Dr. Shingle says rest is often the best remedy for most sports-related injuries.
Well, I always tell my patients for a lot of injuries, you can play through an injury as long as it's not going to cause long-term problems. And the basic treatment for sprains and strains that are not going to be long-term problems that will heal that you can play through are rest, ice, and anti-inflammatories. And most athletes are okay with the anti-inflammatories and the ice, but they don't want to take the rest. They don't want to miss it, even a game. And sometimes you have to. You have to take a break and let your body recover. And part of the art of sports medicine, of course, is to decide when to take that rest. If it's at the beginning of a season, then often it's best to talk with your athlete and let them understand that if they take the rest now, they'll be able to compete later on at a higher level when it's going to be more important to them and potentially to their team. And sometimes when it's at the end of the season, for example, a Final Four or a Rose Bowl or a Super Bowl, you know, you sort of tough it through and make it through the season because there'll be rest after, theoretically, that is.
The year-round nature of so many sports contributes to many athletes' sports injuries, says Dr. Shingles.
You know, it's springtime, and in the past when I was playing sports, when summer came, that was time off. There weren't all these camps. There weren't all these summer leagues. You had the summer to rest and relax. And sure, you played sports with your friends, played some baseball, but you took a break from everything else and your body recovered. Sports have become so competitive across the board that athletes aren't getting a break in the summer. There's summer camps for almost every sport. And now, if you're a basketball player or a soccer player, you can play year-round. There's leagues year-round. And most athletes, or some athletes at least, and athletes' parents, and to some extent coaches, like that. They want their athlete as prepared as possible, give them that chance to potentially play at a Division I-A program or even make it to the pros. So what we're seeing once they get to a Division I-A program in some situations is they have injuries or chronic overuse injuries that we see in our middle-aged patients. You have kids coming in that already have arthritis. You have kids coming in that have been playing on chronic injuries so long that it's starting to catch up on them. That's tough because now how do you treat this kid or this athlete? Do you let them play with their arthritis that they're coming in with? Do you tell them that you worked so hard to get here but you really shouldn't do anything else because potentially you're doing more harm to your body? It becomes a much more difficult problem that we haven't had to deal with before. Now to be drafted in the NFL or the NBA, they're doing a battery of MRIs and x-rays to look for those things because they're so prevalent.
If you're resuming your fitness activities with the onset of warmer spring weather, MSU Sports Medicine's Dr. Michael Shingles advises you to ease into it and to consider incorporating some cross-training into your routine.
For athletes that haven't done anything all winter and they're just starting to get back to a exercise routine, start off nice and slow. Slowly progress their amount of running, for example. If they've been running for years and they enjoy it, but they're starting to get some aches and pains in their joint, whether they've seen a physician before or not regarding this, to try and extend their career or activity as long as possible by cross-training. For example, if you're a runner and you enjoy running a lot of mileage, but you're not able to do what you did before, then cross-train with riding a bike or swimming, which is overall probably the best exercise on the weight-bearing joints, such as the hip, the knees, and the ankle, because you're not impacting those joints. You're not pounding on them as you take every step. Swimming takes that out of the equation. One of our strategies for an athlete that enjoys a sport, but they have been diagnosed with some early arthritis, which is a problem that we can't fix. We can't reverse the arthritis. Arthritis is loss of cartilage from a joint, and that will progress. The only thing that slows that progression down that's been proven with studies is keeping an optimal weight. Well, to keep an optimal weight, you need to eat well, but you also need to exercise to a certain degree. So while exercise can sometimes progress the arthritis, it's also very important for the rest of your body, your heart, your lungs, keeping your general health stable. It's also important for keeping your weight control. So finding an exercise program that works and doesn't exacerbate your pain from the arthritis is a good tool in order to meet all those goals.
For more information about MSU Sports Medicine, please visit sportsmed.msu.edu.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
Doug Bueller leads MSU Ag Bioresearch.
MSU Ag Bioresearch is really located strategically within Michigan State University, and we concentrate on research in agriculture, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bioresearch is changing the face of science.
Our mission really is wise use of the resources, both human and natural resources, and also to protect the productivity and profitability of our natural resource and agricultural systems.
More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, I think the most important thing we do is to continue to try to develop production systems that can put safe food on our plates, but also protect the environment and also a situation where the producers can make a good living and protect their resources at the same time.
MSU Ag Bioresearch, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.